Retro.
Go.
Fido.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, and good afternoon, a spooky Halloween greetings to all of you along Florida's Space Coast who are listening in today on this scary October 31st edition of Space Talk on WMMB, or perhaps around the planet, listening in live online right now to WMMBAM.com. I am Jim Behnke. This is the Halloween edition of Space Talk, brought to you by our friends at United Space Alliance, innovation you can trust and performance you can count on. And you are invited to join in on the conversation today, as usual, by calling 768-1240. Locally here, if you're an AT&T wireless customer, just punch in *1240, and you'll get directed in a free phone call right here to the studio. And out of town, give us a call, the area code 321-768-1240, or if you are prefer to send your email or comments online, we're monitoring our AOL address, which is spacetalking@AOL.com. Gets us right here into the studio here. We'll keep an eye on that for you as well. So lots of ways to participate this afternoon, and a lot to talk about today. Of course, the big news this past week, the Ares 1X test flight went pretty much without a hitch. Took off on the second day after finally shaking free of the rule about tribal electrification, a term we now hope to retire from our lexicon here along the Space Coast. Let's not ever discuss it again, I hope. But the clouds did clear. The rocket did take off. It looks like the biggest thing to talk about was that one of the parachutes may have failed or it looks like it did fail on the way down and caused some buckling of the booster stage. But that's not something that's a showstopper, and certainly lots of time to fix that. But, you know, Bill Mick live Tuesday morning out at the press site of the Kennedy Space Center, and we were there with him for the full coverage. And during the course of the conversation out there, we had some callers call in and say some things that, you know, frankly, I was a little amazed by, and discussed, touched on a couple of things that I just gotta clear here, gotta clear the air on. And there were three things. Let's see if I can get to them all here quickly. First of all, the question again coming up several weeks later, water on the moon. Why were we bombing the moon? Why was NASA bombing the moon to find water? And not so much the whole deal about bombing, which I think is just a crazy word to use. We're not bombing the moon. But in any case, the sentiment was, and I've heard this before, that we have plenty of water here on Earth. So why are we looking for water on the moon? And, of course, the answer is we're not looking for water on the moon because we don't have enough here. We're looking for water on the moon because we want to use that water on the moon for whatever purposes our future in space holds for us. If there's water on the moon, water, as you know, I hope you know, is made up of molecules of hydrogen and oxygen. And as any high school science experiment can prove, you can break down water into the individual components, the elements of hydrogen and oxygen, and use that for a variety of purposes. Oxygen, obviously, to breathe. Hydrogen can be used to make rocket fuel. Hydrogen and oxygen in combination with some other elements that we could bring up and chemists can mix together can lead to all sorts of other things and materials that we could use up there on the moon. And if you can use stuff on the moon, that means you don't have to carry it from the Earth, which means it's cheaper to operate, less stuff to carry, and it's all around a better deal. So we're not looking for water on the moon or on Mars or anywhere else because we need water here. We're looking for water there because we can use those resources. And as we've learned on Earth, wherever there's water on Earth, there seems to be life. And so the intriguing mystery of the universe is there life out there? Well, if there's water on the moon, or proof that there was water or is water now, if there's proof there was water or is water on Mars, the chances that life might exist in some form is also just a great science mystery that we can solve, and I think gets people very excited. The other big thing, and I'm going to spend a little time talking about this, the sentiment that is expressed by so many people in saying why we don't need a space program is they say we need to take care of things here on Earth before we spend all that money in space. Well, of all the short-sighted, ill-conceived, idiotic, unreasonable, absurd, and in my opinion, downright stupid things a person could believe, I mean, it takes home the Lombardi Trophy for being the most foolish argument against going into space. First of all, if you believe that, if you believe that we shouldn't go out into space until we take care of all of our problems back here on Earth, if you believe that and actually live your life that way, well, I feel sorry for you. I feel sorry that if you are living your life that way, then you must be stuck in your home. You must be unwilling to venture out until everything is perfect in your own world before maybe reaching out to your neighbor or traveling to another state or a country. You know, I was thinking the logic of that argument. I was thinking, you know, in my home right now, which is about 20 years old, you know, the shower in our master bathroom is basically falling apart. It needs a lot of work, and it needs to be remodeled, and it's going to cost a few thousand dollars to repair and do that work someday. But at the same time, two of my three boys are at college age. They're in college. The third one's joining those ranks of the college age when he graduates from high school this spring. You know, and if I believe that I should take care of everything at home first before considering anything else, you know, the kids wouldn't be in college. We would be spending money on the shower. And then when that's fixed, I'm sure we could probably use some new carpet. And then when that's taken care of, it's probably time to buy a new car. And then, you know, the walls could use a coat of paint, and some new furniture might be nice. You won't get me into the furniture store, but it might be nice to have some bought. You know, I sure would like some palm trees planted in the front yard. I think that'd be really great with some, you know, colored lamps pointing up at night, you know, lighting them all up. And then, of course, there's always the new widescreen flat LED television with a Bose sound system so that I can watch the Vikings beat the Packers this weekend in high definition. Now, this is not about needs and wants. If you believe we should take care of things at home first, then I just don't see how you get out the door. I don't see how you grow. I don't see how you ensure there's a future for our children. I don't see how you can live in such a flat, boring, unproductive, unexciting manner that frankly goes against the very basic nature of human nature to explore. We will never, I repeat, never solve all the problems on Earth to everyone's satisfaction ever. You know, but we can use the resources available to us in space to help solve some of these problems on Earth. And it takes basic space exploration to be done first to see what's out there so we can learn how to live and work out there and utilize space to help us solve our problems on Earth. I mean, thanks to our, you know, the early space exploration efforts that we've done, Apollo and all of that, you know, we now have weather satellites to warn us of approaching storms. We've got navigation satellites to keep us pointed in the right direction. And you know, I mean, did you know that farmers use the GPS system to help them be more productive in their fields? It's just one example of the thousands that are out there. You know, we have communication satellites to get people, you know, talking that might not otherwise be able to. You know, a great example of communication satellites is the way the doctors can remotely help patients thousands of miles away by linking them up together on satellite. You know, communication satellites let us see the Vikings beat the Packers in Wisconsin, and it just goes on and on from there. You know, all of this is happening in space. All of these things are helping us solve our problems on Earth. We're not spending money in space. We're spending it on Earth. And when people are asked if they want to continue to do that, you know, there are people out there who say we shouldn't spend money out there, that it's too expensive and dangerous. And I just can't possibly agree with that in any way, shape, or form. And so anyway, the little rant there for now. You know, when we return, we're going to be joined by a four-time shuttle astronaut who can tell us firsthand about his experiences in space and why this is so important to follow. More on Space Talk on WMB right after this.
And now back to Space Talk on WMMB.
Well, and welcome back to Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. Once again, your call is welcome here at 321-768-1240. Star 1240 and the AT&T Wireless customers here locally on the Space Coast, or send us email to spacetalking@AOL.com. Just one follow-up here from the beginning segment, and that is that there are folks out there that don't believe we should be spending money on space, as I said. And in fact, in the poll that Bill Mick had on the first day of the Ares 1X attempt, you know, we asked about to Brevard what direction you think we should go with the Augustine panel report coming out. And 47% of the respondents said to the moon, 6% said to the asteroids, 19% said to Mars. And that's a pretty good mix. That pretty much follows the national average. But 28% of the respondents, and I realize this is not a scientific poll, but 28% of the respondents said none of the above, that space exploration is expensive and dangerous. And, you know, that just left me dumbfounded that even in our own Space Coast there would be people that would respond with that. And I wonder if some of those people that answered that way are like the story I've heard time and again I like to tell about the woman who was told that one of the benefits of the space program was that it could monitor the weather. We have weather satellites up there that can monitor the weather. And she said, who needs the space program for that, she says. She says that when I want to know what the forecast is, I just turn on the weather channel. And there's all the information right there. Now, if that's not a scary thought for Halloween, I don't know what is. Well, let's move on to something a little more positive and a little more productive in the future. And let me start it by saying this way. There are two people that I have worked with in my career who share names with other famous celebrities. One of them is Julie Andrews, and the other is Tom Jones. And when I was working in the newsroom at Florida Today, it was always fun that I'd get on the phone and I'd say, Julie Andrews, please. Or I'd be saying to someone, I'd say, I'm holding for Tom Jones. And the look you get from other people's faces has always been priceless. So on this Halloween, it's kind of an amazing trick of the day because it is a coincidence that Julie Andrews, who's worked for so many years at Lockheed Martin in their communications department and public affairs, she's actually retiring this year, and she's going to be here at the Cape for her final Atlas launch on November 14th, 2 weeks from today. So we wish her well, and we'll certainly say hello to her personally as the time comes. But coincidentally, the other famous celebrity name that we have is joining us right now on the phone from his home in Houston. It's four-time shuttle astronaut and now respected author, planetary scientist, Dr. Tom Jones. Tom, welcome to Space Talk.
Thanks for having me with you, Jim.
Good. Well, last to chat about, let's start with some of your astronaut experiences first. We'll kind of move on from there. You were selected the class of 1990. You flew four missions, twice on Endeavour in 1994, Columbia in 96, Atlantis in 2001. Let's talk about those two flights on Endeavour, because that's one of the intriguing things about your career. You got to fly once on Endeavour and then turn around and go right back up again. Like, what was it, 3 months later, 4 months later?
Well, the original goal was to fly the same payload, the Space Radar Lab, in two different Earth seasons. So we flew in April, and the idea was to go in late summer to get a look at the Northern Hemisphere spring and then into late summer with that fantastic cutting-edge radar imager.
Yeah.
So I was the crew member selected to go on and fly the second mission, and it was going to be about 4 months apart. And at the time, in 1994, that was going to be close to a record, if not setting the record for intervals between space flights. And then we had a wonderful and really hair-raising pad abort
right
on August 18th, 1994, aboard Endeavour, where the main engines fired up to full thrust, and then 1 second before liftoff, they saw a turbo pump overheat, and the computers on board the Endeavour shut the engines down, and we sat there swaying on the launch pad.
I wondered if you could feel that.
Oh, you could actually look out the side hatch of Endeavour and see the gantry swaying
oh,
back and
geez.
Forth. And of course, it was us on board that were moving,
right,
out the gantry. So that threw away the chance at a record. But what happened was we changed the engines out and flew about 6 weeks later. So I flew about 6 months apart in April and then on September 30th, 1994, on those two flights of Space Radar Lab. And those were fantastically successful missions to study our changing planet and looking at everything from climate change to geology to volcanism and pollution and so
yeah.
on.
What,
and
what?
That flight those two flights led to a global digital terrain map of the Earth a few years later.
Incredible technology, and I guess borrowed from the Magellan probe that went to Venus. Is that correct?
Yes. NASA took planetary exploration technology, like the radar imager used to map the surface of Venus, which is always cloud-shrouded, and then applied that in spades to studying our own planet. So we had a real state-of-the-art imager built by the Jet Propulsion Lab and by the German and Italian space agencies, and flew that in the payload bay of Endeavour. And Endeavour provided the pointing and the power supply and the communications links and the thermal control, and then the instrument was able to be tweaked and reflown twice with me and my two crews, and then the same instrument augmented for this digital terrain mapping mission went up in 2000. So it was a wonderful example of how the shuttle as a science platform could return really groundbreaking results.
And from the perspective of the astronaut experience, Tom, I mean, you knew going up on the first flight that you were assigned to the second one. Were you able to approach, and that would have been your rookie flight the first time up, right?
Yes.
Were you able to approach it any differently, any other different kind of thoughts about going up because you knew you were going back up again so quickly?
It was a little heady to think that I had two space flights assigned before I'd even done my first one.
Yeah.
And it was also intimidating and daunting because here I was flying as the only rookie on STS-59 on my first mission, and I'd already been told that I'd be flying as the payload commander on the second flight only 4.5 months later. So I really had to make extra sure that out of that first experience, I soaked up everything I could observe and learn like a sponge, so I could bring that along to my new crew and give them the benefit of the experience that we gained on Space Radar Lab 1. So that was the big challenge, was in just that remaining 4 months to transfer all that knowledge immediately to the second crew in a way that would make it practical and easy for them to benefit from those lessons and then to apply that to making the second mission even more successful. And in several ways we did. We took more science imagery with our cameras. We certainly recorded more digital imagery on the second mission than the first because the ground had been broken and the instrument had been broken in by that first mission. So we got a lot more out of the second mission, probably another 20% data return, in fact.
You know, there's no shortage of fun stories to tell about your flights, and we certainly enjoyed covering them as journalists back then. You know, Columbia, 1996, Thanksgiving Day. Let's see, I'm at my home in Melbourne with the family gathered for Thanksgiving. Your family is probably gathered for Thanksgiving somewhere. You are in space wearing a spacesuit with Tammy Jernigan locked in an airlock. I'm locked in my bedroom trying to cover what's going on in your airlock while the rest of the families are all downstairs eating and festivating and watching football. And you and I are both stuck. And guess what? I could get out of my door, but you couldn't.
Yeah, we were in tight quarters in the airlock for a couple of hours while we struggled on Thanksgiving evening to try to open up the outer hatch and go on our spacewalk, the first of two on that mission. And Tammy was the lead, and I was her number two, and we both tried to muscle that hatch open, and it was mechanically jammed, and we could not rotate the hatch handle the full one turn, 360 degrees, to bring that hatch off its seals and get it out of the way and get outside. And talk about frustration. We had trained for a year, probably more than 130 hours underwater to get ready for those two EVAs. And here we were both ready to go outside on our first spacewalk, which is sort of the peak the astronaut experience, and we could not get outside the hatch. So it was very frustrating, and we realized that our families were all watching in prime time and digesting their Thanksgiving dinners. And even in Mission Control, we heard later that folks had brought their Thanksgiving meals in to sit at the consoles and enjoy those meals while we were working outside. And those meals were forgotten in the frenzy of trying to bring all of their analysis to bear and get that hatch open.
I can't even imagine what it would have been like for you up there doing that. Now, and on that flight, and Tom, we got about 2 minutes before our next break here together, but tell me really quick about the Wake Shield facility, because when I researched it and wrote about it for the flight, it was such a great, promising technology and a great promising spacecraft, and it had to do with growing growing things in a pure vacuum and films and whatnot. What's the legacy of that? Has there been any follow-up to that after the several flights it's made? Have you kept track of that?
Well, the Wake Shield satellite was a great experiment. We flew it for the third time on that same mission, STS-80, designed to essentially make computer chip wafers in the cold and clean vacuum of space. And so it was a well thought out endeavor to try to bring the electronics industry into orbit, perhaps build factories there that would use that clean environment to make semiconductors more powerful, more efficient than we could make here on the ground. But what happened was, over the course of the 4 or 5 years that satellite was developed and flown, its experiment in orbit substantially worked. However, the laboratory and manufacturing technology on the ground caught up with the ability of doing that in space. And so, given the transportation costs to and from space, the economics of transferring and manufacturing to orbit just didn't work out in the mid-1990s, and it still probably does not. So, you know, it was a proven method of making electronic components in space. However, the ground-based facilities can outcompete that currently, so there's no move to follow up on that.
Wow. Okay. Well, look, we're gonna pause here. We're gonna take what's our built-in 5-minute hold here at the bottom of the hour, and when we come back, we're gonna talk more with Dr. Tom Jones about some of his astronaut experiences. Talk about the solar system and some things that are out there near our Earth that we should be concerned with, and again, a spooky kind of a tale to tell on Halloween. In the meantime, we can take your call 768-1240, 321-768-1240, and see you on the web at WMMBAM.com. More with Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance, after these messages.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And good afternoon, everyone. Back with you on a Halloween edition of Space Talk, sponsored by United Space Alliance. Once again, reminding you that you can give us a call at 321-768-1240 or send us an email, spacetalking@AOL.com. And with us from his home in Houston, Dr. Tom Jones, 4-time shuttle astronaut veteran, now an author and a distinguished speaker and all-around good guy. And we want to, Tom, let's do it this way. Let's combine past, present, and future with this kind of question. We're talking about Halloween and scary ghost stories and tales of things happening in space. I believe it was on your Columbia mission that you also were flying some experiments involved with mice. And it got a lot of attention back then because you had this neat little tool you were going to use to take care of the mice, and there's sort of a tabloid element to this whole thing. But I know that the science coming from that was important. Your last flight, you put up the Destiny science module, the U.S. module, the station. You got to fly to the station. And we're looking to the future now also with what to do with the station and where we're going. Can you kind of string that all together and tell us about what you did on that Columbia mission and the value, the continued value of space science on that outpost?
One aspect of working on the space station today for crews is to understand how the human body can remain productive and healthy for long-duration missions. And if we send astronauts on the new Orion spacecraft out to the nearby asteroids, or we want to send them to Mars one day, they're going to be in free fall for at least 6 to 9 months on a Mars voyage, and the asteroid missions might last anywhere up to 6 months. So yeah. We need to understand the changes that go on in the human body. On our Columbia flight back in 96, we carried 14 laboratory rats along with us to study their reaction to free fall. And in particular, we were looking at how the calcium levels in their blood changed as their skeletons lost bone mass in free fall.
Right.
And by having the rats on board, they experienced free fall. They were able to then return to Earth, and then being studied in the lab, we would learn how those blood changes and calcium levels affected the rest of your physiology. So that was an important stepping stone towards keeping people healthy for the long run. And on the space station today, they don't have any laboratory animals yet, but I hope one future expansion of the space station will be a centrifuge module where you will take laboratory animals like rats, for example, spin them at Mars gravity or at lunar gravity for months at a time to see if the protective effects of another planet's gravity will be sufficient to keep humans from suffering the ill effects of free fall that we see on the space station. So it was a one step forward in trying to understand how we can become a multi-planet spacefaring species.
I remember you reporting back then that that the rats were able to adapt quite well to zero-G in terms of how they got around their little enclosures and were able to
exactly,
get to their
yes,
food
they
and
were,
all that.
They were in a big locker about the size of a big dresser drawer that we could pull out to examine through a plexiglass panel. And they adapted very quickly. Rather than floating aimlessly inside their box, they used their little toenails, their little claws, to engage the mesh lining of their container. So they could walk around on the walls and parts of the ceiling with apparent ease and agility. So they didn't seem to be affected much by the free fall. They had a food and water supply that we replenished periodically, and so for almost 18 days, they were our fellow passengers.
So was
I remember Ken Cockrell, our commander on the launch pad, saying, though, he says, they don't have any idea what's about to happen
to them. That's right. Well, I was going to say, and it's only humans that learn how to push off of one wall and go to the other side and float across like Superman, right? You didn't see any rats doing that.
They would from time to time, but I think that they were more comfortable being engaged on a flat surface, and so they could pretend, as we can in space, you can pretend any direction is up or down. Once they latched onto that mesh, they could pretend that that was the floor that they were running on.
Well, now, so past the shuttle missions now, and you retired from NASA, and I should mention, too, that you also served in the Air Force and a retired captain in the Air Force, actually, before you joined NASA. Taking all that experiences, and you've authored and co-authored a variety of books, some about aviation, some about space, and while I haven't read the aviation ones, I was intrigued by them. You've got quite a background in some air history, and I'm told especially to ask you about P-47 pilots during World War II.
That's right. That's the theme of my current book called Hellhawks. I'm the co-author with Bob Doerr, and Hellhawks is a true Band of Brothers story about an aerial band of brothers flying the P-47 Thunderbolt against the German army in World War II in Europe, and their job was to be the flying artillery for Eisenhower's GIs on the ground. So without that air cover and the firepower that these Thunderbolt pilots and their maintenance men brought to bear on the German army, our victory in Europe 65 years ago would have been much more costly and taken much longer. So this is a true story of some of the heroes I had when I was growing up in the 60s reading about fighter pilots. And then I had the chance in writing this book to interview many of them. We interviewed about 80 World War II vets for our book and put their stories together in Hellhawks. It's the top-selling book at the National Air and Space Museum because It really takes you into the cockpit of a P-47 Thunderbolt pitted against Hitler's Panzers.
The rights to the movie sold yet?
Well, we'd love to have it be on film, and I think once we get over this phase where every movie is about comic strip heroes, then we'll get into some real hero stories.
That's right. That would be great. That'd be great. Well, and let's go to the space stuff, too. Of course, you wrote Skywalking, which is sort of your astronaut memoir and telling the astronaut story. Very well done book. Lots of neat stories, and you've told a few already. But I want to talk about the planetology book, Unlocking the Secrets of the Solar System, Taking Advantage of Your Planetary Science Background. This is an incredible book, by the way. Beautiful, informative, I think very easily accessible to the layman. What drove you to produce it and get it out when you did?
Well, you can get a look at planetology at my website, astronauttomjones.com. There's a big cover image right there and some background on the book. But it was started because of my experiences on Space Radar Lab, those two Endeavour missions back in 94. One of the scientists for Jet Propulsion Lab planning our science targeting on the mission was Ellen Stofan, who's a volcanologist and a planetary scientist in her own right.
Uh-huh.
And so we, even 15 years ago, said we should write a book about how scientists explore other worlds and our own, taking the knowledge we get from the solar system probes that NASA has sent out and using that knowledge to further understand the world, our planet Earth, that we live on. So planetology is about the processes that shape our Earth and the worlds in the solar system. It's got all of the latest digital imagery from around the solar system, as well as stories of exploration of our planet from Ellen's point of view on the volcanoes of our planet and from my point of view circling our world and seeing changing phenomena on our own planet.
And it is an absolutely outstanding book, and so what I'm about to say is not a negative on the book itself, but it's amazing to me also, Tom, that as soon as you put this book out, we keep learning more things. We keep finding more discoveries every day with Hubble and with the ground-based stuff and all that. I mean, the images that NASA released, 2 weeks ago with Saturn and a brand-new ring, the biggest ring around Saturn that was discovered. This just must be amazing that there's so much stuff happening and we keep learning more and more. I mean, you must want to do an annual update the way it's going.
We were really pained because we couldn't fit in the latest results from, for example, the MESSENGER flybys.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We have one image or two from MESSENGER, but we don't have anything from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So the results keep rolling in from our planetary neighbors. And, of course, planetology, our book will have to be updated with multiple editions. We hope that'll happen.
That'd be great.
But we have a representative selection of all of the worlds that we've explored. And, of course, we're waiting for the next chapter on Pluto to be written.
Well, and I was just about to ask you about Pluto because you do have in the book that that when you do the big picture of the solar system, you mentioned that Pluto has kind of been downgraded and it's not included in the big two-page spread there of the solar system. What's your personal feelings on that? Is it a planet? Is it not? How do you define that?
Well, the solar system is shot through with change, and so goes the naming of planets. I think we're in a phase where one small group of astronomers decided that Pluto was to be a minor planet. In my view, Pluto is the representative prototype of all of those icy worlds out there beyond Neptune, and so I think Pluto deserves a place as a classical planet because of its historical discovery and associations, and I think it just represents that larger class that we will term minor planets. So, you know, it's just a phase we're going through. I think Pluto will make the textbooks again as a full-fledged planet.
Well, let me ask you this, and this is kind of a basic question too, but, you know, we all know kind of the layout of the solar system, and you've got that asteroid belt out there, and we're going to start talking more about near-Earth objects here in a few minutes, but that asteroid belt, Tom, why is it there where it is? Is that a planet that broke up, that didn't form? Is it something about gravity that rocks that size just fall into? What's that all about?
Well, hundreds of years ago when astronomers laid out their map of the solar system, if you will, they noticed this large gap in space between Mars and Jupiter where ordinarily you might expect a planet to be circling given the distances of the other planets from the sun. Bode's law predicted that there would be a planet between Mars and Jupiter, and there was none. And then around 1800, we started to discover these small fragments, leftovers from the formation of the solar system that we call asteroids today. And the initial supposition was, these are the pieces of a planet that must have been there that then shattered, and we see the debris today. Well, it turns out the story is even more interesting than that, in that a planet was probably growing in that region, but as Jupiter ran away with sudden massive growth, sucking in hydrogen and helium and all of the material around it, its gravity became so immense that it stirred the pot where this planet there was cooking after Mars and Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And it never was able to coalesce because of the stirring action of Jupiter's gravity. So Jupiter terminated the formation of that planet and then flung those fragments out of the solar system to a large extent and into the inner solar system where we're still running into those pieces today as asteroids and comet fragments and cosmic dust. So Jupiter played a big role in controlling that region, and what we see there in the asteroid belt today are the leftover shards of that forming planet. They date back to the earliest days of the solar system, 4.6 billion years ago. But if you added up all of the stuff out of those millions of asteroids out there in the asteroid belt, it would only be about 5% of the mass of our moon. So there's not enough material to make a planet. It's all been ejected from the solar system by Jupiter's gravity.
And a lot of those pieces now begin to get a little too close to comfort for Earth. And we're going to talk with Tom after this two-minute break a little bit about these near-Earth objects. Stay tuned, back more as we continue Halloween on Space Talk.
It's an Endeavor roll program.
Roger, roll, Endeavor.
Now is the time for shuttle program employees to chart a new course.
OTCSGO.
A course that will take their careers beyond the last space shuttle mission to new job opportunities and horizons.
Pilots, go.
Brevard Workforce is helping our community shuttle engineers, technicians, and administrative workers to launch new careers through the Aerospace Workforce Transition Program.
Houston, flight is go.
While they continue to safely launch the remaining shuttle missions. Through the programs, resources, and services, aerospace workers can map out a strategy, undergo skill assessments, take workshops, update degrees and certifications, or receive education funding. Assistance is available and ready.
PTC, go.
Contact Brevard Workforce today and take the first easy step to prepare for a successful post shuttle career in aerospace or other industries.
The launch team is ready to proceed.
Call Brevard Workforce at 394-0556. That's 394-0556. Visit them online at launchnewcareers.com or Twitter them at launchcareers.
You are go for launch.
Okay. I was waiting for that one. That's a good one, Aaron. Thanks. Well, this is Jim Banky back with a final few moments with Dr. Tom Jones, four-time shuttle astronaut, planetary expert, author of all things aviation and space. And, Tom, we did just get a question via email on spacetalking@AOL.com from Walter from Rockledge, and it's just the very topic we were going to talk about. And so let me ask his question to get into it. How can we energize a global response to defending Earth from hazardous near-Earth objects? I mean, what are near-Earth objects? What are the hazards? What can we do about them?
near-Earth objects are the pieces of the asteroids and comets that enter the inner solar system and approach or cross the orbit of the Earth. And so, in large part, they're fragments of that main asteroid belt that are pushed in towards Earth by collisions with each other and by Jupiter's gravity, again, influencing their orbits. So we run into these fragments, and we have been running into them ever since the dawn of the solar system.
Mm-hmm.
And impacts by asteroids and comets, these near-Earth objects, have actually changed the course of biological evolution on our planet time and time again. As you know, they wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
They're suspected of acting to cause other mass extinctions during Earth's history. And they will continue to occur, and our society, our civilization, will go the way of the dinosaurs unless we learn how to travel in space and learn how to deflect these objects from hitting us in the future.
So a couple of bad movies have been made about this, and any semblance to reality? I mean, how big can we deflect? How soon can we get there? What do we got to know?
They were great entertainment, but I think the two movies, Deep Impact and Armageddon, are basically telling us that this is a real phenomenon that we have to deal with, but the technology employed in those movies is totally unrealistic.
So
it's an easier job in many respects than those movies portrayed.
Well then talk about that, and then talk about, you know, the Augustine panel and others trying to determine the future direction of our space program, hardware, architecture,
sure,
destination. You would propose we do more to study asteroids and these near-Earth objects, that they're maybe a little more important to us than maybe some of the other things we could do.
Well, near-Earth objects have dual personalities. They are a hazard to the Earth over the long run, and they are also a potential great benefit to us in exploring and utilizing space. So let's talk about the hazard, first of all. There is no global plan or mission designed to deflect a nearby incoming asteroid if one shows up on our telescopes in the near future. Right now, we don't know of any that are headed for an imminent collision, although several have probabilities of running into us in the next century or so. There is no global plan, and our alumni group, if you will, the Association of Space Explorers, the
right,
Cosmic Flyers alumni group, is now trying with the United Nations to develop an on-the-shelf plan for both warning us of a pending impact, designing a mission to ward off an asteroid, and then finally executing it with the help of the spacefaring countries around the world. And we're just getting started on that kind of an agreement at the United Nations. It'll meet again. The Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space will meet again in February 2010, and our Association of Space Explorers will be there to advise and push forward that process.
With just about 2 minutes left, Tom,
the
size of these objects that we're concerned about. We had an asteroid suddenly show up on a telescope two weeks ago, came within the orbit of the moon, but very tiny, which is why it was discovered so late. Do we need to worry about the real big stuff that we can plan years in advance, or is there one right now a month away that we wouldn't know anything about?
The greatest odds of an impact today are no warning at all and a small object impact. So just 3 weeks ago or so, we had one blow up in the atmosphere over Indonesia with an explosive power of about 50,000 tons of TNT. It didn't make it to the ground. But our search has largely ruled out the civilization-ending impacts from objects about a half mile across or bigger. We've found 85% or so of those. That's been a NASA goal for the last 10 years. But
yeah,
objects that could kill a city are still roaming around undiscovered, thousands and thousands of them. And one of the pushes for the space agency in the future, I believe, should be to find those objects that could devastate an inhabited area. And then we got to flip the coin around, change the rules in our favor, and get our astronauts out there and our robots to explore and then utilize these objects. They provide, for example, water. Many of the asteroids have water in the rocks on their surfaces that could be used for propellant and for life support on long-duration voyages, or to establish outposts on the moon or the asteroids, or eventually even boost our travel to Mars. So they're the key raw materials for our future expansion into space.
Now, finding those asteroids that you just talked about, does that mean going back to the moon as a goal and building a big telescope? Does that mean more money and funding for using the existing telescopes that we have? What do we got to do?
No, the good news is that it's very cheap to look for these things. We're talking over 10 years about maybe three-quarters of $1 billion over 10 years to build up the telescopes on the ground that are already on the drawing boards that are needed to find the hazardous ones and then identify potential mission targets for both the Orion and Constellation spacecraft with astronaut explorers and robot encounters. And we can use the combination of both robots and people to really gather the information about resources, like I said, water and other volatile elements, even some very high-value metals like the platinum group elements, and also find the information we need to potentially deflect one in the future. By taking the measure of these asteroids up close, we'll learn how to apply our engineering skills to deflecting them.
And
it won't require nuclear explosives. Most of these objects can be deflected by either kinetic impacts, like the Deep Impact mission a few years ago, or just by a subtle tug from a gravity tractor spacecraft.
Yeah, interesting. In 30 seconds, Tom, can we go get an asteroid and bring it to Earth orbit and park it in Earth orbit and then mine its resources?
It's not efficient to do that. You could do it with massive amounts of rocket fuel, but to move 1 million tons of asteroid anywhere from where it's already going would be extremely energy intensive. So what we need to do is bag up and package the resources we do want and ship them out of the gravity well, which is almost nothing,
right,
of one of those asteroids, and retrieve that material near the space station or near a lunar orbit where we actually have a factory that can process that stuff.
That's great. Tom, thanks for joining us today. We could probably spend another 2 hours on this subject, and maybe we will do it again. But thanks for spending time with us today. Happy Halloween, and go get your candy ready.
All right, and check out astronauttomjones.com. Thanks, Jim.
You bet. That's great. Thanks, Tom. And we do have links to Tom's website on our website, WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk, along with a couple of links to Amazon, which you can purchase his books through links on our page and help out Space Talk at the same time. Well, as we wrap up this Halloween edition of Space Talk, a reminder to please keep an eye out tonight for the trick-or-treaters. It's safety first in the space program, and I hope it's safety first in your neighborhood. If you must drive tonight just after sunset, please take it easy. Take it extra slow. You get an extra hour of sleep tonight anyway, so no one should be in any hurry to get around tonight. Make sure the kids are safe. If you have candy to share, of course, keep your light on. And if you don't have candy to share, then what's your story? You still have time to get out to the stores and get something. The kids are counting on you. We certainly thank you for coming by to stop in and listen to us today. Thanks for the email. Thanks for listening in. Don't forget that you can stay with us and updated on what we're doing at Space Talk by going to WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. We'll do updates on the site. We'll have the podcast available on Monday or Tuesday and keep you up to date on what's the latest going on. So I guess that's about it for now. This edition of Space Talk brought to you by United Space Alliance, innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. I am Jim Banky. You're listening to WMMB. Happy Halloween, everyone. Take care, be safe, and keep your eyes open tonight. Thanks.